Gotta read the fine print, gang, because oftentimes economic headlines aren't the whole story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 29th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Today, it turns out, is one of those days where the economic news is not all that it seems to be. You've heard by now, I'm sure, that the American economy grew at an annualized rate of 6.5% in the second quarter. That's April through June. And that's good. It's great, even, but not the 8-something percent everybody had been guessing. Below expectations, though it may have been, today's reading does mean the economy's caught up to where it was before the pandemic started. Except, you know, technically, we're still behind. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains.
In the first half of 2020, the economy lost $1.9 trillion. 11.3% of economic output disappeared into thin air. And at one point, we were down 22 million jobs. Constance Hunter is chief economist at KPMG.
This is the largest decline in GDP the U.S. has experienced since World War II.
Just as dramatically, we've managed to reverse that decline. According to today's data, it was sometime this spring that we got back to where we were, in terms of GDP, before all the lockdowns. But that's not the same thing as getting to where we would be now if COVID had never happened and the economy had kept growing.
People still graduated from high school, they graduated from university, they were ready to hit the workforce, and they were hampered from being able to do so because of the pandemic.
So when do we get to the point at which it is like the pandemic never happened?
That's going to take a bit longer, and it would probably happen around the second half of 2022.
Paul Ashworth is chief U.S. economist at Capital Economics, and his estimate is conservative. Some economists think we could be completely back as if nothing happened by the end of this year.
It's possible. It all depends on what happens in the second half of the year in terms of economic growth.
But the U.S. lost more than just economic output that it has to regain. It also lost jobs. Lindsay Piegza's chief economist at investment bank Stifel.
Jobs might take longer. We're about 70% recapturing the jobs lost since the onset of the recession.
When it comes to how the Delta variant will affect the progress we've made, economists say they aren't totally sure. Piegza says there are some people out in the economy for whom the Delta variant changes things.
That's going to impact their decisions on how they behave, everything from eating out to going back into the office.
But she says there are millions of people, vaccinated and not, for whom Delta changes nothing and who will continue about their economic lives. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Whole lot of unknown unknowns, right? Okay, one more word here about Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve meeting that wrapped up yesterday. We gave you the skinny about the substance of what Powell said, but there was something else that caught my ear that I thought it might be useful for you to hear. It came off a question from David Gura. Once upon a time, a Washington correspondent for us and then a Friday regular when he went to DV. And now, he works for another public radio outfit, let's just say. But anyway, here is the question Gura asked.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask if you've started drafting your Jackson Hole speech, but I'm going to go in a different direction here. Steve Leisman asked you about semantics, and I'm going to take a cue from him and ask you about the term transitory.
He gets a laugh out of Powell, which is always nice.
I wonder about this term and what you would say to people who don't know it definitionally, don't know what it means, and see prices going up and wonder how long they're going to have to wait.
And that's a really good question, because Powell and the rest of us have been throwing that word around like we all share the same understanding.
You keep using that word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
I'm sorry, I couldn't help that. Anyway, here is Powell.
The concept of transitory is really this. It is that the increases will happen. We're not saying they will reverse. That's not what transitory means. It means that the increases in prices will happen. So there will be inflation, but that the process of inflation will stop.
All right. So here's a little bit more.
What I mean by transitory is just something that doesn't leave a permanent mark on the inflation process. Again, I don't mean that you know, producers are going to take those price increases back. That's not the idea. It's just that they won't go on indefinitely.
Powell gave, to be clear, a 2.5-minute answer to Gurr's question. Those were the most relevant bits, I thought. Transitory does not mean, in the official J. Powell dictionary, that all the price increases we're seeing are going to go away. And that seemed important for you to know. Not as important, but still of note, Wall Street does not care about the definition of transitory, the state of the virus, or darn near anything else, it seems. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are awash in numbers about the housing market. We give them to you all the time. If only then we were awash in houses. Today's numerical contribution is pending sales of existing homes, deals under contract that is that have not yet closed, down about 2% May to June, so says the National Association of Realtors. Apparently, stratospheric prices driven by a shortage of available homes is dampening buyer enthusiasm. Similar story, by the way, for new homes as well. Sales of those fell almost 20% in June from the same time last year. But what if I told you some of that decline was intentional? Marketplace's Amy Scott is about to.
If you've been shopping for a house and haven't already gone mad, this might do it. Home builder Pulte Group reported $500 million in quarterly profits this week, and CEO Ryan Marshall told investors it could have been more.
We purposely restricted sales through lot releases or similar actions in roughly 75% of our communities across the country.
Yep, they sold fewer houses than they could have on purpose.
You can pick the phrase, it's metering, it's throttling, it's intentionally slowing sales.
And, says economist Ali Wolf with research firm Zonda, 85% of home builders are doing it. Given shortages of land, labor, and materials, Wolf says they can't build houses fast enough.
A builder could choose to sell a lot of homes, but then they're going to have really unhappy customers who said, you told me this would take 8 months to build. And why is it taking 12 or 13 months?
Better to disappoint would-be customers than really tick off people who've already given you their money. Then there's the cost of building. Rick Palacios Jr. is head of research at John Burns Real Estate Consulting. He says lumber prices have come down, but things like plumbing fixtures and appliances keep going up. And that makes setting a price today for a house that won't be done for months risky.
So what they're doing also is they're waiting longer in the construction phase to actually price that home and put it up for sale because of how volatile the costs are.
There is hope for frustrated buyers. Zonda's Ali Wolf says fewer builders are throttling sales now than they were last month. Once they clear the backlog sometime next year, we'll only be short somewhere between 1 and 4 million houses. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Hey, Apple said today it has cleared up that glitch that was preventing your podcasts from downloading. So that means you can download our podcast, get it right on time. Check it out if you need us. The federal government's official drought tracking service says at least 86% of the American West is experiencing severe drought conditions right now. Not enough water coming in, a lot going out to people and farms out here means the reservoirs along the Colorado River are at historic lows. That is bad for those of us who depend on those reservoirs for water and hydroelectric power. It's also bad for the tourism-based businesses that surround those lakes. Lisa Duncan is the general manager at Temple Bar Marina over on the Arizona side of Lake Mead. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, so look, did we catch you in your office by any chance? Is that where you are?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm in my office.
Good. Do you have windows in your office?
I do.
Good. Look out and tell me what you see out on Lake Mead there.
Oh, it's a beautiful day. We've got clouds. I see the temple. That's what we're named after.
Fair.
And it's just a beautiful day on the lake.
The catch, of course, is that there's not a whole lot of water in the lake now, right? Can you see that from where you are?
Oh, I can see that. We have the whole bathtub ring.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just keeps, the water keeps dropping, so we just keep getting more and more of the white.
So what's that doing to you as you try to run a marina on a lake where, you know, the water's going away?
Well, it's been really hard. We were doing okay up until the point the water got so low that we had to close the launch ramp, which has then just impacted the motel, the restaurant, or retail store. On the bright side, though, lots of people put in early into the water, so I only have one slip left available at my marina to rent.
That's interesting. People saw it coming that it was going to be tricky to get into the water, and they came early, basically.
They did. By April, all my smaller slips were taken. All I had left as of last week was a 70-foot slip. So you have to have a pretty big boat to want that
I was just going to say, if you've got a boat that fits in a 70-foot slip, you got other issues. So what does this mean for your business? I mean, it does not sound sustainable to be running a marina on a lake that's in the kind of stress that Lake Mead is.
Yeah, it's really hard. We work closely with the National Park, and they're looking at ways to extend the launch ramp. I fingers crossed, maybe they can do something, but I just don't see it for this season. So we're really hoping next season we can get that launch ramp and get that taken care of. But yeah, it's a tough season this year. If it wasn't for the marina floating us, so to speak, without that marina business, we'd be really hurting.
Right. So all of which is to say, you're kind of at nature's mercy here, I suppose, as we all are, but you more than most.
We are. I keep saying that nature's trying to take back the river. She doesn't want a lake anymore. She wants the river back.
Yeah. Full disclosure, we were supposed to do this interview the other day, but you got jammed up in part because you had some people quit. Do you find people leaving and sort of seeing the handwriting on the wall and saying, this is going to be tricky for me to stay?
Yeah, it is. It's everybody who's been leaving. It's our food and beverage.
Yeah.
Because there's just the restaurant's just not busy. So they're taking other seasonal jobs and moving on.
Yeah.
So it's hard.
I was reading an article in the Los Angeles Times the other day about Lake Mead and the problems you all are having, which is why we're on the phone with you. But I came across a word that kind of hit me really hard. What's going on out here now is not a drought, right? It's aridification. It's just getting drier and drier and drier out here in the West.
It is. It's been going on. I mean, this is 20 years of the lake dropping and dropping. We're basically at the mercy of how much snow the Rockies get.
Yeah.
And if they keep getting the snowpacks they've been getting, we'll just keep dropping.
So let me ask you this, and I hate to end on a downer, but how much longer can you be in business at the Temple Bar Marina?
That's a good question. A lot of it's contingent on getting the launch ramp. If we have a launch ramp, people are going to come because it's still a huge lake.
Yeah.
Without the launch ramp, it's really hard on us.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you. Lisa Duncan, she's the general manager at the Temple Bar Marina out on Lake Mead. Lisa, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
You may love it, you may hate it, but you know who it is.
Tell you what, though, people are buying it. First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 153 points today, 0.4%, 35,084. The NASDAQ picked up 15, about a 0.1%, 14,778. The S&P 500 added 18 points, 0.4%, 44,019. That home builder that Amy mentioned in her piece, Pulte Group, gained 4.6% today. Another home builder announced results today. Taylor Morrison Home Corporation fell short of estimates for revenue and earnings nevertheless, because capitalism shares added 6.8%. Mattress maker Tempur Sealy International also hit a record high after beating estimates and announcing expects sales to grow by 35% this fiscal year. Shares gained more than 15%. Bonds, just to squeeze those in, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose 1.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Okay, sorry. One last thing from Jay Powell, not from yesterday, but from a year ago.
The problem is the circulation kind of stopped because stores were closed, banks were closed.
I was in a store the other day, maybe a gas station or something, and I saw a sign that said, basically, exact change appreciated, we don't have any coins. And I said to myself, the coin shortage from last year when, like Powell said, everything was closed, that is still going on? Turns out, yes, just don't call it a shortage.
It's not that there's a shortage of coin. There's plenty out there. It's that it's just stuck in someone's drawer or jar and not getting taken back into a retailer or even to a financial institution.
That's Lance Noggle. He's with the Credit Union National Association, also part of the Fed's U.S. Coin Task Force. And he is as surprised as anybody that that task force is still in business.
When I joined, I thought it would be a short-term issue. I'm shocked.
Yeah, me too. But as he will tell you here, we ought to get over that.
With the continued use of electronic payments, you know, we think that that could sort of be the new norm where it doesn't circulate quite as fast.
Mea culpa on this one, by the way. I bet it's $200 I've got sitting in various milk bottles at home and in my office. I'll tell you what. Bars in most, maybe all, actually, parts of the country are open again. And in almost all of those places, those bars are struggling to find enough people to work. We have talked a lot about that. A lot of bartenders, though, are also missing a key ingredient. Marketplace's Caroline Champlin is on that one.
In Killington, Vermont, Patty McGrath's Irish Pub just got some troubling news from their distributor. Guinness supply may be limited.
Well, that would certainly put a dent in things. We are the biggest seller of Guinness in the state of Vermont.
They need it for pints, of course, but they also need gallons for their Guinness stew. But can't they just switch it with another stout?
No. No, I'm not sure that's a possibility.
Vermont is one of several states reporting alcohol shortages. But Mandrake Bar in Los Angeles is having problems, too. Owner Flora Wiegman says reopening has been like starting a new business.
It really was building a new menu and then building the new menu again based on what was available.
She says bourbon, tequila, and wine are among the orders that keep getting delayed. The holdups left many bars in a tight spot after already being closed for months, says Reed Beckers with Classic Beverage of Southern California, one of Mandrake Bar's suppliers. From his perspective, a step up the supply chain, the alcohol is there. It's a shortage of labor and materials.
Glassware. Glassware is just a killer. Even if you have the product ready, you can't get it packaged.
Also, kegs and aluminum cans are hard to come by. According to Patrick Anderson, CEO of Anderson Economic Group, inefficiency is a function of the industry. After Prohibition, he says, each step of the supply chain got regulated.
One of the reasons for the system we have is temperance, meaning we're not really encouraging you to drink. And second is to levy taxes.
So when demand is hot and there's shortages in one place, the whole system slows down. For the sake of moderation. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
Okay, Crocs, those spongy, rubberized, clog-looking things. How do you feel about them? I've got my doubts, as you'll hear in a minute, but I will tell you what, they are having a moment. The company reported earnings the other day, revenues up 93%. Andrew Reese is the CEO of Crocs, and we got him on the phone the other day so I could ask him, basically, y'all just get lucky or what?
Everything involves a bit of luck, yeah. So I think we've gotten a bit lucky, but we've also been working really hard at this. So Crocs has been a brand that's been in a turnaround for some period of time that involved, you know, repositioning our product and marketing and really growing the business. On top of that, we've really managed to ignite the brand and make it more and more relevant with a younger, passionate consumer, and we're growing at a breakneck pace.
Talk to me about that turnaround for a second, because, you know, you of all people, but certainly anybody who's seen Crocs over the past, you know, I don't know, decade, two decades, they were hot, crazy hot for a long time, and then they kind of fizzled, and now they're back. How do you manage a company through that? What do you do?
Yeah, so I joined the company in 2014, which probably was one of the more recent troughs. I think the company is a very young company and really had failed to put in place a lot of sort of basic infrastructure about how do you run a global brand. So when I joined, we set about putting that infrastructure in place. The right team, we have an incredible team today with seasoned industry professionals, the right business processes around product development, around supply chain, and then really focusing on our consumer. We targeted that what we call a young explorer consumer. She's urban, she's fashion conscious, she's global in nature.
I'm assuming the pronoun is intentional?
The pronoun's intentional. They are also male, right? So the young consumers, but they're definitely biased towards female. They're on social media. We never had a brand awareness problem. Everybody knows who Crocs is. You know who it is. You may love it, you may hate it, but you know who it is, right?
Well, that's actually a good question, right? Do you care whether people hate it? I mean, it's all the only bad publicity is no publicity, right?
That is almost correct, yes. Yeah. So, look, we don't want to have publicity about something the company does that's inappropriate, right? But we don't mind some consumers hating the brand, right? The bifurcated nature of the brand, the ability for some people to hate it and some people to love it is just super important.
Are you benefiting from the pandemic-induced but already in progress casualization of American dress, do you think?
Yeah, we are absolutely benefiting from casualization. And you said it well there, which is it's the pandemic has helped to accelerate it, but it's been going on for some time. You look at the broader footwear industry. The penetration of sneakers and athletic wear in the industry has grown dramatically over a 20-year period. And it's grown because they're frankly way more comfortable and way more versatile than a pair of, you know, black leather dress shoes.
Does it bother you at all that, and I don't know, this is fine, I'll just own it, uninformed speculation, but I'll bet you if you stopped, you know, 10 people on the streets of Manhattan or any town in the United States and said, what are Crocs? They would say, oh, they're those clog things. Does it bother you that you have different product lines, but probably not too many people know about them?
No, it doesn't bother me. That's an opportunity. You know, I think if you have a core iconic product, that's a reason for people to know who you are. And as we talked about, love or hate you, right?
Yep.
That puts you in the conversation. If you're in the conversation, then you have a, you know, better than finding chance to tell them about all the other things you do. So we just launched socks this week. You know, Crocs and socks has been a thing for many years. We hadn't had our own range of socks. That's a huge opportunity.
What took you so long on the socks? I mean, come on.
Well, we wanted to get it right, right? We wanted to do something that was different in the marketplace and approachable. But that's a good call. I could or should we have done it faster? Maybe.
On that point of Crocs being more comfortable than, you know, black leather business shoes or what have you, as it happens, I am wearing a pair of black leather business shoes right now. And even though this is public radio, if I were to show up in the newsroom tomorrow wearing a pair of Crocs, people would look at me like I had three heads, you know?
I don't know. Maybe that's your own preconceived notion, Kai, right? I think they may look at you and think you were smart, you were walking your own path, and you were really confident about your fashion choices. So I kind of might think about it a different way.
All right, well, maybe I'll roll the dice. I'll let you know. Andrew Rees, he's the CEO of Crocs. Mr. Rees, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I have been warned, I should tell you, by the entire production staff of this program that I should not show up wearing Crocs. Just that. Anyway, this final note on the way out today, which you have to believe is the first of many lawsuits by big-name actors and maybe lesser-named actors as well, against what seems to be becoming a new business model for Hollywood. Scarlett Johansson is suing Disney because it released her latest, Black Widow, on Disney+, that is, streaming, as well as in theaters at the same time. Johansson says her paycheck was based in large part on an exclusively and more lucrative one imagines theatrical release. I've seen the movie. I kind of liked it for what that's worth. Okay, we're going, but here is your moment of economic context, mostly for the investing-minded among you. You might have heard Robinhood went public today, the gamified stock trading app that was right at the center of the whole GameStop and AMC frenzy this spring. Well, this one is from the marketplace desk of We Read the Disclosures So You Don't Have To. Robinhood's S-1, that is the form it filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission about its initial public offering. The risk factors section, the stuff that could go wrong if you buy their stock, it is 75 pages long. By way of comparison, because that's always handy, Facebook's risk factors when it went public, 22 pages. So, there you go. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.